the headlines. More than 100,000 Palestinian worshippers hold Eid al-Adha prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds amid tight Israeli restrictions. Last, rock the Afghan capital Kabul as several rockets land near the presidential palace during Eid al-Adha prayers. Also in the headlines, China rejects as fabricated allegations by the U.S. and its allies that Beijing was behind a massive hack of key Microsoft servers. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Some 100,000 Palestinians have performed prayers at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to mark Eid al-Adha, the Feast of Sacrifice. The prayers were held amid tight Israeli restrictions at the holy site in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Israel tightened the curbs several days before the Muslim religious festival and launched a crackdown on Palestinians there. The prayers at Al-Aqsa are part of ceremonies by Muslims worldwide to celebrate Eid al-Adha. That marks the end of the Hajj pilgrimage. As part of the celebrations, Muslims visit friends and relatives also. Some sacrifice animals like camels and sheep and donate their meat as charity. The practice aims to honor the prophet Abraham for his willingness to sacrifice his son as an act of obedience to God's command. Muslim pilgrims have conducted a major Hajj ritual near the Saudi city of Mecca as the annual event has reached its peak. Worshippers wearing simple white clothes have thrown pebbles at the devil symbolically in the tent city of Mina. The rite to stone the devil will be repeated for the next 2 days. After the third day of stoning, pilgrims will stream back to Mecca to pray at the Grand Mosque at the end of Hajj. The annual ceremony usually brings to Saudi Arabia some 2.5 million people from all over the world. But for the second year, it was downsized due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Only 60,000 residents picked via lottery are taking part in Hajj this year. Yemen Scholars Association has held a symposium in the capital Sana'a to condemn Saudi Arabia for banning millions of Muslims from Hajj pilgrimage. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
On the day of Arafat, Yemen Scholars Association held a symposium in the Great Mosque of Sana'a. The symposium entitled Preventing Hajj is a Deterrent from the Grand Mosque and the Service to the Nation's Enemies denounced the Saudi regime's ban on foreigners from Hajj. A large number of Yemeni scholars attended the event.
This move serves the Zionist interests. There is a great conspiracy against Muslims. The Saudi regime has deviated from the path of Islam. All Muslims must get united to protect their sanctities against the Zionist plots.
The Scholars Association issued a statement accusing the Saudi regime of serving the Zionist agenda by targeting Muslims' rights. The statement also condemned the silence of the Islamic nations toward the Saudi practices against Islam.
The decision to ban millions of Muslims from Hajj pilgrimage is in line with the colonial projects. The colonial powers seek to change the nature of Islamic sites. We condemn and deplore the silence of the Islamic countries around the world towards the deliberate targeting of Islamic sanctities. We call on all Muslims to condemn what the Saudi regime is doing.
For the second year, Saudi Arabia prevented millions of Muslims from holding Hajj pilgrimage, saying this step comes amid the precautions against the COVID-19 pandemic, whilst thousands of people attend music concerts in Riyadh and Jeddah without any restrictions.
Yemenis believe that the Saudi regime is deliberately targeting the rights of Muslims, including the Hajj, as part of implementing the Israeli agenda in the region. They say Saudi Arabia has no right to ban millions of Muslims from their right to access holy Mecca. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
More than a dozen diplomatic missions in Afghanistan have called for an urgent end to the Taliban's military offensive. In a statement, the missions said the offensive was at odds with claims that the Taliban want to secure a political deal to end the conflict. The statement was signed by the U.S., the European Union, and some other foreign missions. That follows another round of inconclusive peace talks over the weekend in Qatar between representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban. Two sides said on Sunday that they've agreed to meet again next week. They have been meeting on and off in Qatar for months but have achieved little. This as the Taliban make battlefield gains under a series of offensive first launched in May. Political commentator Tim Anderson says the current state of affairs in Afghanistan is due to the collapse of 20 years of U.S.-led occupation of the country?
Well, it's mainly what we would expect of the collapse of a 20-year occupation, an illegal and criminal occupation, let's remember, with most of the members of that occupation now calling themselves wrongly the international community or the global community. It's a collapse of a puppet regime set up by NATO and led by the US, and it was really to be expected. If anything, it reminds me of the collapse of the puppet regime in South Vietnam back in 1975. Now, apparently, Erdogan's Turkey, which is a member of NATO, of course, is pretending to manage a transition of some sort while they supposedly maintain control of Kabul Airport. But really, this just reminds me again of Erdogan setting up a Syrian national army, and he's now, it seems like he's threatening to set up an Afghan national army too. It's bizarre, and it's an intervention by NATO in this region, which has never had any basis in international norms, international law.
Blast have rocked the Afghan capital Kabul after several rockets landed near the presidential palace during Eid al-Adha prayers. The Interior Ministry said at least three projectiles were fired at the palace. The ministry blamed the attack on the enemies of Afghanistan, saying that it caused no injuries. Despite the attack, President Ashraf Ghani and others continued with the prayers, marking the start of the Eid al-Adha Muslim holiday. Soon after the attack, the president addressed the nation. The incident comes as Taliban militants are pressing ahead with a sweeping offensive across Afghanistan. Earlier we talked to our correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami. He told us that the Afghan president, Ghani, blasted supporters of terrorist groups that carry out such attacks.
The Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, also blamed the supporters of the terrorist groups in Afghanistan for launching such attacks and said that, and directly pointed out to this rocket attack and said that those who are behind this rocket attack want to show that the people of Afghanistan will face a very intense fighting and a very dire situation in case they ignore to approve the demands of the supporters of terrorism. Instead, President Ghani stressed that the nation of Afghanistan will strongly stand alongside the Afghan National Security Forces in order to protect and defend their own country. However, the Afghan President Mohammad Ashraf Ghani also directly blamed Pakistan for backing terrorism in Afghanistan and spreading war and violence. He once again called on Islamabad to stop interfering in internal affairs of Afghanistan under backing terrorism and supporting the terrorist groups inside this country.
Well, it's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Syrian air defenses have intercepted an Israeli attack over the northern province of Aleppo. Military officials say that the air defenses downed most of the Israeli missiles that targeted positions in al-Safira area. There's been no report of casualties. Syrian officials said that they were assessing the damage caused by the attack. They said work is also underway to repair the main electricity cable to Aleppo after directed cut power. Over the past several years, Israel has carried out aerial attacks on Syria, leaving civilian casualties on some occasions. Syria has repeatedly urged an end to the attacks, saying that they violate its sovereignty. Well, correspondent Mohammed Ali joins us to tell us more about that from Damascus. And for an analysis, Rodney Shakespeare joins us. He's an academic and commentator. Okay, Mohammed Ali, tell us exactly what has happened.
Yes, according to an official military source statement yesterday, what happened was that at about 11:37 p.m. Last night, local time in Damascus, the Israeli enemy, and I quote, carried out an attack targeting some Syrian army positions around an area called Al-Sfera, which is southeast of the city of Aleppo. Air defenses were able to intercept the enemy missiles and shoot down most of them. This is what came out officially We still have no information if there were any casualties. It seems not, since that they were not mentioned by the Syrian army. The foreign ministry did not also comment on the issue yet, but usually in such when such Israeli attacks happen, the foreign ministry sends letters to the United Nations calling on the international body to shoulder its responsibility in pressuring and forcing Israel to respect international law and the UN Charter and the sovereignty of independent states.
Okay, so Rodney Shakespeare, taking a look at the situation. So you have Syria that's been attacked on numerous occasions. You have an area by the name of the Gaza Strip that's choked off from the rest of the world. You have threats that are being made against another country. You have assassinations that take place on foreign soil. And all of them have one thing in common, and that's Israel. Why is Israel allowed to get away with all of that?
Yes, American and Israeli policy in West Asia is to smash up any independent state so that there can be no resistance to the expansion of the Zionist entity into the lands of others and the annexation of the lands of others. We know from General Wesley Clark that American policy is to destroy seven countries, states, in West Asia. And we know what's happened. We know what's happened to the attempt to destroy Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and of course they want to destroy Iran. So it's all the same thing. It's Israeli and American policy destroying any sort of independent state which can stand up to the expansion of the Zionist entity, and that's what it's about.
Muhammad Ali, I don't know if you maybe mentioned this, but I'm curious as to the route that Israel has to take in order to get either near or fly over Syrian airspace in order to, I guess, target whatever it is that they're targeting in Syria. Can you tell us about that if you can?
Yes. Sometimes Israel, when attacks Syria, if we're speaking about surface-to-surface missiles, they use the occupied Syrian Golan for this purpose. And other times, when there's an airstrike, Israeli fighter jets violate either Syrian airspace or even Lebanese airspace, putting in danger even civilian flights over Syria or over Lebanon. At the end, it's very clear that Israel does not care about civilian lives. It's attacking directly sometimes civilian areas inside Syria, so definitely it's not going to care about civilian lives in airplanes, in civilian airplanes and air flights over Syria or Lebanon. So there are multiple violations that Israel carries out when it attacks Syria. And the Syrian Foreign Ministry makes clear always that such attacks are in direct support of the remaining terrorists inside Syria. Why it says that? Because facts on the ground confirm this issue. Because during the war on Syria, we remember how when terrorists used to occupy parts of the Al-Quneitra area, which is near the occupied Syrian Golan, it used to give direct logistic and military support and medical care to those terrorists of the Al-Nusra front there. So it's not a surprise that Israel is attacking Syria. Israel is an enemy to Syria. Israel wants a weak Syria, and it wants to undermine the capabilities of the Syrian army in fighting terrorists. It does not want a strong Syria. So it's actually not a surprise that Israel is attacking Syria and any member of the resistance front.
Okay, and finally, Rodney Shakespeare, as our correspondent there, Muhammad Ali, mentioned, sometimes Israel actually flies over Lebanese airspace. It puts civilian aircraft in danger. But what would happen in the case, and I know we're talking hypothetically here, or my question is on a hypothetical possibility here, but what would happen if the Syrian, let's say, fighter jet gets downed? Then what? Then you would probably have the wrath of God coming down on countries involved, and they would go after each and every country, perhaps. I mean, is that what we're looking at?
Well, the risk all the time is a conflagration throughout West Asia. Though if that conflagration ever starts, you should remember that the the puppy dog regimes like Saudi Arabia, UAE, which are backed up by the West because they suppressed any democratic movements. In any conflagration of a general sort, those regimes may well be in danger of being toppled or falling. So you look more widely at the disgraceful behavior that's going on, and if at one stage if it blows up, it will blow up against the long-term interests of Israel and the USA, because the tide of history is not with Israel and it is not with America. The tide of history is with the peoples of the West Asia region.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Rodney Shakespeare, academic and commentator. Muhammad Ali, it was a pleasure talking to you, correspondent there from Damascus. And with that, we come to an end of this news review. China has slammed the U.S. for its, quote, fabricated allegations that Beijing was behind a massive cyber attack on Microsoft in March.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept it.
China's foreign ministry spokesman said that his country resolutely opposes and combats any form of cyber attacks and will never support them. On Monday, the U.S. and its allies, including New Zealand and Australia, accused China of hacking Microsoft Exchange. That's the name of a platform used by corporations around the world. They also accused China of a global espionage campaign. Also on Monday, the U.S. State Department charged four Chinese nationals with what it called malicious hacking. And that is for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Shadow World, directed by Johan Brumman Perez. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Tete Kopi, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Shadow World gives you an alarming behind-the-scenes tale of the global arms trade, revealing the complicity of the US and British governments working with corrupt regimes in the world, and how this determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democracy, and creates widespread suffering. And in shedding light on how our realities are being constructed, the film also offers a way for audiences to see through this horror in the hopes of creating a better future.
I've got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
The heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed. And it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror, it's nonsense. It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
It destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs, they're like food. Munitions, that's got, you know, sell by there. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby that BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, won the biggest contract, $10 billion. Quite scarce public resources on this weaponry that we didn't need.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroys the Middle East, not Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place on screen.
Once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it, it controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary was a very politically charged film and also quite very eye-opening and covers a lot of ground about the global arms industry, which is a trillion-dollar industry. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Shadow World?
Well, it's a very detailed, comprehensive look at the exploration of the arms deal, which seems to rally its audience into political action. I didn't feel that it did anything particularly shattering, but what it did was it kind of crossed the T's and dotted the I's. And then it also tried to be a bit sort of poetic. So you have all these numerous talking heads, but they're peppered with these poetic and melodic extracts from Eduardo Galeano's stories. And in that way, the filmmaker trying to make it somewhat more cinematic because it is a lot to digest.
Mm. And of course, it could serve as a comprehensive guide to those who don't know much about this topic.
No, exactly. It's not quite the idiot's guide to arms deal, but it is very intelligently done, very exquisitely edited, and it does give you sort of a very potted history at the issues behind it.
And Tete, if I could turn to you now, what was your take on this film?
Well, trying to understand the arms industry and actually the way of real politics today, without watching this film, it's like trying to understand Hamlet without a crib sheet. You don't understand the language, you don't understand the idioms, you don't understand the context within which everything is being done. So you probably won't have comprehension. I found this film.
Of course, that's a lot to ask to squeeze into a 90-odd minute film.
Well, and I always ask myself first, look, did he need 90 minutes? And I think, yes, he did. And he used the 90 minutes extremely well. Because ultimately, for any cinematic experience, I walk away with, what was the impact? The impact was, I'm really pleased I had breakfast before I watched this movie, because I felt a little bit dirty after watching it. A little bit like
watching... And why was that? Yeah.
Because all of it was so kind of resonant with me of why things are in the world they are today. And it's happening in broad daylight.
And of course, you were saying how there were talking heads in this, but they weren't just any talking heads. They were very high-profile interviews. You had top journalists like Robert Fisk, senior American politicians.
Yes, and you also had that arms dealer, which apparently was very difficult to get hold of an arms dealer to come into the film, because the director said that the first rough cut was 4.5 hours long, and he'd interviewed 50 people and kind of condensed it to 15. But with people like the arms dealer, it kind of adds colour, because at the end of the day, they are just talking heads.
Mm. I mean, at the beginning, what absolutely got me bolt upright was a banal statement like, actually, when you're doing an arms deal, your secretary's ass could give you the edge. Then later on in the clip you showed, where he said that politicians are like prostitutes, it's just that they're a little bit more expensive. It's the banality of that world, which actually ordinary people in the street cannot believe can be happening in the world of multi-million dollar corporations and the heads of state who we voted to put in place.
Mm-hmm. So Shadow World's an apt name indeed for the documentary. But we'll just have to move swiftly on just for now.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores.
Cheney commissioned a study by Halliburton to find out how much more of the Defense Department could be privatized.
Halliburton, proud to serve our troops.
Halliburton was elated to get this $1 million contract and, of course, returned a verdict that, oh, Mr. Secretary, lots more of it can be privatized.
Dick Cheney leaves the Defense Department and goes and heads Halliburton himself. And he spends the entire 1990s building up the Halliburton war empire.
Well, if we're going to talk about Star Wars, we might as well invite Darth Vader. I'm happy to accept.
Then he comes back into power as vice president, and then they start hiring Halliburton to, you know, in advance even of U.S. troops going into Iraq, Halliburton personnel and equipment was being deployed to the Gulf. It's hard to look at this and not say these guys had a very long-term plan for how they were going to increase the powerful infrastructure of private companies. What we've essentially done is to create a network of corporations that have the firepower of small nation states that could, you know, overthrow some small governments around the world.
In essence, we in the United States have privatized the ultimate public function, war.
Really, you believe there's no such thing as coincidences. Marie, what was your reaction to connections being made between the U.S. military, the government, and oil companies? And what else does the documentary suggest about the ulterior motives of the government?
Well, part of me was shocked. Part of me was resigned to this hideous, dark shadow world as it's described, and that we have no power to do anything about it, because all this is done behind closed doors, you know. It's all about sweeteners and kickbacks. And as it said in the film, that war is a commodity. And it doesn't matter how many people die, the longer that lasts, the more money people make, whether it be at the top of government or, you know, these arms dealers. It's disgusting. It's appalling. And you do feel dirty afterwards, but you kind of feel powerless. And the film doesn't really give you an alternative.
Perhaps there is no alternative in real life there.
Maybe not. Of course, now, with the Trump administration, we would hope that
there isn't that secrecy because he does everything via Twitter and we have the biggest arms deal. I'm putting that in inverted commas because he hasn't said that. But, you know, back in the Reagan era and Thatcher and all those, it was all done secretively.
Which is highlighted in the documentary.
Yeah, and even up to Obama, which that was quite surprising, but not because it's government, so they can do whatever they want, really.
And Tete, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Maria said, and what did you make of these connections being made?
Very much. I mean, I split the movie, the doc, into three parts. Part one was the arrant vulgarity and banality of it, with the arms dealer making those statements about politicians and prostitutes, things like that. The bit where they showed a whole Saudi sultan being given a commercial airliner, and the banality of him painting it in his favourite American football colours. I mean, if I was a Man U supporter, I'd have liveried it up in red, for example. Then the second part is that it goes into the culture and the rationales which are given to enable this to happen, and the institutions that support that culture, which is what we've just basically watched. Now, I could not help but expand this documentary into history, and I place at the start point towards the civilization we have now reached at the start of the transatlantic slave trade, because this was the first time an activity, slavery has been known since the dawn of civilization, but this was the first time it was actually industrialized. And with the industrialization, you had to create a philosophy and a culture which enabled it to go on, fly in plain sight with the support of ordinary people. And this is the bit that this documentary does so extremely well.
Well, that's a fascinating point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move swiftly on, and we'll pick up your next point in the next part of the discussion.
I denounced the call to invade Iraq publicly. The New York Times issued me a formal written reprimand, which is what you get before you're fired under union rules to stop speaking out against the war. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief. I mean, I'd been in Iraq, spent 7 years in the Middle East. How can you come out of Gaza and not be angry? What's being done to those people? How can you come out of the Sudan, El Salvador, dozens of other places I've been and not be angry? I've seen the bodies of a lot of children, which I can't forget. Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love, and that's what kills people. I fully get why people blow their brains out. It's really hell. And I don't use love as a kind of hallmark schmaltzy, we all gotta love each other. I'm saying that the only way you're healed from those experiences is by reestablishing a connection with that kind of power, with another human being. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. And I have friends who couldn't do it, and they're not here anymore.
Very emotional account there. Maria, do you get a sense from this documentary that there is a lot of frustration and a lack of support for these ongoing wars?
Well, there is, but the problem is, and what the governments do so insidiously is to instill terror and fear into the populace. And so that gives them carte blanche to do what they want militarily. And so people sort of believe what the government tells them. And so we're in this vicious circle that correspondents, brave correspondents, like you've just seen, try to get the truth out there. And they're literally, smacked down. And they try to gag them. Mm. And that's appalling. And it shouldn't happen, but it does. And it's still happening today.
Mm. And it reminds me, actually, Claire Short, former Labour politician, she says that the war on terror is sort of almost like a manufactured concept to keep this sort of perpetual wars, and it's sort of used as a scapegoat. Would you agree with that,
Tessa? A marketing man's dream is a product that creates demand for itself. It becomes a perpetual motion machine, and you can't stop it. And I call this part of the documentary the state capture bit. That's the expression we actually use in South Africa for when private people latch onto the state and leech off it. Because that's what's happened with the arms companies and their lobbyists, is that actually they are running the state. And that's why that arms dealer can say that the politicians don't run anything. They're just more expensive than prostitutes. It's the banality of that. And I think that at the end, this documentary works because of the sense of outrage. It can fire up in people. Some people will also just feel, what's the point? I give up. We don't stand a chance. But many, many people will be outraged just by being able to join the dots of the fact that these private contractors have got a stranglehold on government. And actually what government does is as a result of what is profitable to the contractor. And some of the governments, of course, people are corrupt. Imagine the ANC taking that massive... African National Congress. Taking that massive kickback when hundreds of thousands of poor, ordinary Africans' lives could have been saved with retroviral drugs. But they went for that because the ANC wanted to stay in power.
Well, going back to the documentary and a really fascinating point you made, there's four main targets, I suppose, of the documentary seems to be the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. How are the four countries portrayed in this documentary, Maria, and how are they connected?
Well, they're not portrayed terribly well, really, because they're in it for the money. You've seen Blair, who brought in new Labour and was, the spiritual light here, who's going to bring all this hope. And yet, you know, he was in it for the money. He was getting, kickbacks and stuff, allegedly. But what was interesting there is that the influence that the Saudi royal family had on him, and where you had Prince Bandar come over and say, hold on, the serious fraud...
Serious fraud office, I believe.
Sorry. Having this investigation into these crimes, and they were getting very close to him. And he said, no, you need to stop this. Otherwise, we're going to remove the security and there's going to be blood on the streets of London. And then you have Blair turning round and basically the guy says, jump. And Blair says, well, how high, more or less? That's disgusting, really.
And
he got away with it. But then he was, Teflon Tony, nothing stuck to him. And it's the same with all the other countries. You know, what surprised me was that they didn't look at the drone warfare, which is, and also cyber warfare, which is now becoming...
The documentaries in their own right. To
exactly, and we've probably covered that already. The thing is that all these countries, nothing kind of surprised me about it, that they were all interlinked. They don't come out very well from the documentary, and they... you didn't think well of them, then it will compound what you thought. It's speaking to the converted, really.
Well, this takes us to a really good, great point. We're just going to move on again.
Fiscal year 1999, $2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, $1.1 trillion missing. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other.
$1 trillion $1 bills stacked high would reach nearly 68,000 miles into space, one-third of the way to the moon.
I got a phone call from the FBI saying that I was a target of a death threat. And that's what happens when you go against the big boys.
Who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
There are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that corporations can get out of the penalty box, if you will.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
The second question, I've forgotten what the second question was.
Individuals operating in the shadows and never having their names called are able to leverage the power of the military and the foreign policy apparatus for their own personal pecuniary ends.
What now? Who's the enemy? How do we justify all these tanks, all these planes, all this bullshit?
What better new enemy than an hypothetical, invisible enemy called the War on Terror?
Rumsfeld looked quite smug and incompetent there. Maria heard you laugh. Why was that?
Because he wasn't incompetent. He knew exactly what he was doing and he knew he could get away with it. And he has, you know. And that poor woman was the one that was then ostracised and found it very difficult later on in her career. So these people get away with it. That's the problem. And it's wrong. But what can you do? What can we do?
And Tessa, would you agree with Maria? How do you think of how Rumsfeld was portrayed in this documentary, and was it accurate depiction?
Well, the funny thing, when I was watching it, I actually thought it took me back to one of the scenes in the Godfather movies when the mafia bosses are lined up in front of I think it was a grand jury or a commission of some sort, and the smugness with which they behave literally said that whoever's asking the questions, I own your boss. So, and it's the confidence of knowing that he could pull her leash in at any time that he wanted, and sure enough, she's got death threats by the FBI. Whether they're true or false, it's almost lethal pressure to make sure that these people comply. It's extremely difficult, but I actually feel that you can over-egg the pudding to a point. And for the confluence of certain events in world affairs, the nationalism that's rising in Europe, Brexit that's happened in Britain, Trump and all the excesses that he's associated with, I think actually we have reached a turning point in which many of these old ways will not be able to function in the way they did before.
So this documentary raises greater and greater questions and makes us question society. Do you think this is a testament to the documentary then, Maria?
I think so. Like I said earlier, it doesn't really reveal anything new, but
it's certainly thought-provoking.
But it's thought-provoking, and it makes you think, and it kind of joins all the dots, basically, because we knew all this. But when you see it there in black and white or in colour, it's slightly different, and it does make you really angry. You know, you end up screaming at the screen because it's so frustrating that these people, on the face of it, got away with it. And
so just a final thought from the film?
But you see, the interesting thing is that there is another documentary that follows this, which will have to put the last piece of the jigsaw in place, which is that actually our collective standard of living is built on the excesses we're seeing in this movie. And it is, I think, when that story is told, that people will connect the fact that actually there isn't so much of an otherness around somebody who behaves like a gangster in creating public policy, and the car that I'm driving on the street, and the fact that my salary is what it is. All of this thing has a cyclical kind of connection, and people will start to join those dots as well.
Very powerful note to end it on. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there as we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you both to my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Allah.
for humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We want to take some examples of how human rights and the banner of a human rights from the United Nations and the Western ideology being applied to real life. So just, you know, examples that I'm going to, from time to time, going to look at, so we can differentiate between Islamic human rights and a Western ideology of human rights. In 1990, the United Nations, they issued a decree or a law, or call it what you like, or a sanction, where they wanted to impose economical sanctions on Iraq. And the idea of that, well, because it tried to get the government of Saddam to withdraw their troops from Kuwait, because that was during the invasion of Kuwait. So even before that, even though the American and the United Nations, they forced Iraq, or the armies of the Iraqi armies, to be withdrawn from Kuwait by force, as you know, the first Gulf War in 1991 happened. With that happening, and for 45 days, the United Nations and America, they bombed everything that has life in Iraq. When I say life, meaning things that are the infrastructure of the livelihood of Iraqis was destroyed, like bridges, under streets, even houses, even bunkers. Like for 45 days, this whole country was brought to ruins. It was sent back to the Dark Ages, right? Not only that, but, you know, this took place 45 days and it was over, right? So the entire country collapsed from within. The infrastructure of the country collapsed. Then you can see that the sanction they imposed on the country itself, this is what concerns us today, is that they said, well, we will not let you trade with anyone. We will not let you deal with anyone. We will not let anything come in and out of the country. The essentials of life you will not get. And if we only can give you food, but under the condition that we take your oil. And so even during these years in 1991 and onwards, that it said the people of Iraq, the Iraqis, they had nothing to eat. They would eat grass, and some of them would grind the seeds of the dates and make bread out of them. Some were so poor that they had to sell everything they have just so they could afford to eat a piece of bread. And so the life was completely destroyed, and the people's livelihood was very dire, to that extent where people had nothing to eat and people were starving. And the United Nations are the same people who are stated and wrote the Human Rights Charter, where they said people have the right to live a free life. And it is the same United Nations in 1990 sanctioned the people of Iraq, not the government of Iraq, obviously, because the government were, you know, they had everything they require. They don't care what happens to people. But in fact, the people themselves were sanctioned. The people themselves were starved. The people themselves were killed under this in 1990 when they issued that sanction, which is just to deprive the Iraqi people of their livelihood. And that was just a preparation for something to come in years to come. Now, before we continue, let us take a break and then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you're still listening to IRIB English Radio and to For Humanity. So we said that the United Nations in 1990 sanctioned Iraq and deprived people of their livelihoods and made them starve and made them literally where people were dying because it was done under the pretext that Iraq has nuclear weapons. Now, as we all know, that after the war took place, they found nothing and they said, well, sorry, we made a mistake. Yes, okay, you made a mistake. But why are the people still being sanctioned? Why is the country still being sanctioned? Why are people still starving? Why are people cannot trade, cannot deal, cannot buy and sell things? If you look at the numbers are staggering, because in 1989, Iraq, the income, the GDP of the country was $75.5 billion, which is a lot more than all the countries around it and even Western countries. So $75.5 is a lot of money for a country on a yearly basis. Compare that to other Western countries that were civilized. And I think that might have been a threat to them. They said, well, you know what? We need to make sure that's demolished. And they destroyed the currency itself. They destroyed the infrastructure. They destroyed everything in their path just to make sure that this group of people or this nation does not survive. So we say, well, here's the thing, that in Islam says, well, if you have a problem with the government, you need to fight the government, not to fight the people. If you want to sanction the government, do not sanction people themselves, because that itself is not a human right concept, that when you have a problem with someone that you cannot solve, you end up putting everyone's life in danger. And you can see that happening around the world, mind you, like for example in Iran, in Korea, I don't know, even Russia and other countries. Some countries get sanctioned because the United Nations, led by America, they don't like their conduct, for example, or they just not following the orders. So the country gets sanctioned. What they don't understand is that these sanctions is killing people, is depriving people of their human rights. In some countries, people might have to resort to, you know, committing sins and committing crimes just in order to survive. So when a person, for example, commits adultery, or when a woman commits adultery just trying to survive, or a person goes steals and kills only because they have got nothing, who's to blame? Isn't that these governments, these systems, this ideology that says, well, we're going to starve 80, 85 million people and we will not give them anything. Why? Because their government is not with us. And if people want to change, well, then let them change their governments and then we will be good to them. What kind of human right is that? What kind of a sick ideology is that? Islam says, no, you cannot do this. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says this is oppression and you cannot oppress people. You need to give people their right. Even if you look at the conduct of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa ala, when he goes to war with other tribes and when he goes to war with other countries or the states that were around him that were a threat to Islam, obviously he never fought himself but was defensive. But he would never harm people themselves. He would always give them the freedom and ask his soldiers to stay away from harming people and not to come anywhere near them. So you can see that the difference between the Islamic ideology and the Western ideology. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil alamin, wa ala ahli nabihi ajma'in, fabihim arsaltahu.
of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.